From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise can help you manage your money in different currencies. With Wise, you can send money to your cousin in Australia with ease, travel internationally without having to brave an airport currency exchange desk, and take away the guesswork that goes along with converting currencies. Wise lets you send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate, all without any hidden fees. Join 16 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
Canva presents stories to keep you up at night. It was an ordinary work day until...
The Singapore presentation is at
3 a.m.
The office was shocked.
That's when we sleep.
Maya made it less scary with Canva.
I'll just record my presentation so Singapore can watch it anytime.
Record and present anytime with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to another episode. Yes, another episode of The Ezra Klein Show. I am Ezra Klein. Thank you for asking. My guest today is Jessica Valenti. I've known Jessica a long time. She's a founder of the amazing blog Feministing. We started out in the early blogosphere together back when blogs were young and everything was wonderful. And she's just written a really amazing book, Sex Object, which is a very personal memoir about being a woman and the tax that being treated continuously and in a million different ways as a sex object takes on you. It's a really profoundly raw and honest book. We talk about it a lot in this interview, but you know, as someone who knows her well, it's in many places hard to read, both in terms of what it makes you reflect on in your own life and in hers. So I really do recommend listening to this, and I really do recommend reading this book, even if you don't think it's your thing. It will sensitize you, or it did for me, to things that maybe you thought you understood, but maybe didn't feel very visceral. Reading it is a very visceral experience. We also talk a lot about the early blogosphere and how blogging and comment sections were different than sort of this age of social media. We talk about how feminism has changed and is changing. We talk about the political correctness wars and Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. We talk about Jessica's advice for writing books. She's written 5 of them, and she has some advice that is maybe not what I was hoping to hear, but it's probably good advice. We talk about all kinds of things. It was a lot of fun to get to sit down with her. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. As always, I've got 3 quick requests for you. One is to listen to my other podcast, The Weeds, which is my more policy-focused podcast. If you're not a listener, I think you'll enjoy it. Another is to share this podcast, put it on Twitter, on the Facebook, tell your friends, send them an episode you think they would enjoy. When you do that, that is how this podcast grows. It keeps us going. It's deeply appreciated by me. And finally, to email me at EzraKleinShow@Vox.com with guest ideas, with show feedback, with whatever you want. I do check that email. I appreciate the discussion. I don't get back to everything, but I really do read it. So without further ado then, here is Jessica. So I know so much more about you now.
Do you?
Your book is very good.
Thank you.
I actually
Thank
read
you.
It.
Oh, well, that makes me really happy.
I read the whole thing.
Oh, good.
And it turns out to be super easy and addictive to read.
That makes me really happy then.
I am super interested by the process of writing a book like that.
Sure.
So you and I have been friends for like 9 years or something,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I was really excited to hear. Remember we hung out one day at your loft in Williamsburg. I thought it was like
yeah,
the most
remember that.
amazing, impressive New York lifestyle I'd ever seen. And now I found out it was like an illegal loft.
It was 100% illegal. I paid under the table to get it. They paid me to leave.
In retrospect, that makes that whole thing
right,
seem even
sense.
More amazing and exciting.
Right. You're like, wow, this is a really big apartment for New York State. Yeah.
It was like the kind of apartments you see on TV.
Yeah. It was completely illegal.
But so we've known each other a while, and I feel like I could have been your best friend for 20 years and not known half of what's in the book.
This is true.
How do you think about revealing that much? And I mean this really positively, but I didn't expect the book to be as honest as it was.
Right.
And I think maybe because I could never, I like would never have had the courage to write a book that honest.
It always makes me nervous when people say that. I'm like, oh my God, what have I done? You know, I think what helps is that I didn't start writing it with the intention of publishing. Like half of
it. Oh, really?
Well, half of it was just like writing that I was doing on the side for myself, sort of like as a catharsis. And then I realized, like, oh, like, this is a book. Like, this is happening. So, like, the actual process of writing the book wasn't, I don't want to say it wasn't hard, but it was enjoyable in a way that was not true of my previous books.
Huh.
But once it was done, the knowledge that people would read it was the difficult part. So, like, these last few months have been, like, really, really difficult.
Was it hard to relive some of the stories you go through in the book?
No. Strange. Huh. I thought it would be. But no, I mean, I was embarrassed at myself at some points, or like a little bit ashamed of myself, like with the drug use and stuff like that. But it wasn't difficult. But I think that, like, this is sort of a negative thing to say about myself, but I think that's in part, like, I still have a pretty third person view of my life. And I think that that's true of a lot of women when you're talking about sexism or difficult things that you've gone through, like, you've sort of learned to take, like, a little bit of a dissociative state.
I was actually wondering about that in the book. Did it feel like that when you were living through it? Which is to say, there's a kind of, when you read the book, you're both like the protagonist and the character who is acted upon.
Right.
And I wondered if that was a sort of way you saw it as you sort of recollected and tried to understand these experiences, or if at the time it felt like that.
No, at the time it felt like that. I have really distinct memories in adolescence of thinking of myself as a character, like almost like seeing myself from the outside, like especially if I was like walking down a subway tunnel and like had earphones in my ear. It was like, oh, this is sort of like, you know, you're in a movie and like the thing is going on. It was very weird, which of course is just like maybe a strange personality idiosyncrasy. But yeah, no, I felt separated from it.
That's super interesting. So let me actually, before we dive all the way into the book, because I feel like there's a ton I want to ask you about that, but I actually want to like situate us a little bit, because not everybody in the audience maybe knows you as well as I do. Tell me about starting Feministing.
Okay.
Because like that's how we know each other. Yes. We know each other from the early blogosphere.
From baby blogging.
Back when blogs were great.
Right. Back when they were amazing. I had finished grad school and I was working at a nonprofit, like a mainstream women's nonprofit in New York, and was...
Are you allowed to say what that nonprofit is? You always are kind of like,
you
know, a mainstream women's nonprofit.
I mean,
okay. Okay, you don't have to.
No, it's fine. I don't really care. It's not like I'm ever going to go work for nonprofits again. It's now what is called Legal Momentum. Then it was called Now Legal Defense and Education Fund. So it was like the National Organization for Women's Legal Arm. They were two separate organizations, but shared like a board of directors.
Got it.
I had an entry level position, like communications assistant, wrote press releases and like did their newsletter and stuff like that. And it was just the leadership then did not treat young feminists very well. And around the same time, whenever a young feminist was sort of quoted in the media, they sort of went to the same two people, same three people again and again and again. And my boss at the time is a guy named Bill Scherer, who I'm sure.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You know, yeah. Bill
Scherer. Also from the from One Blog.
Liberal Oasis. He's the first guy to ever give me a job. So he had hired me and he was like, oh, you should really start a blog. I was like, I have no idea what that is. but okay. And in.
What, give me a year here. When are
this
we?
This is 2004.
2004.
This is 2004.
Oh, pfft. I started my blog in 2003.
Oh, go fuck yourself. And ironically enough, I started it because the guy I was dating at the time was like a sort of a computer nerd and like and knew code, and he like set it up for me.
He knew code so he could sign you up on blogger.com?
No, he built it. Yeah, like he like built it.
I didn't have a real blog knows when.
he totally built it, and I just started doing it. And I think, you know, we were pretty successful from the get-go, and I think one of the reasons we were is because I had a full-time job but knew that I wanted something up on the site every day. I sort of I enlisted two women I was working with, and I enlisted my sister. And so it was a group blog from the start, and so we were doing a couple of posts a day.
Where did the name Feministing come from?
I actually have a scrap of paper where, like, we were like, Feminister. Like, I don't actually think the ER was there. But it was all this fighting, like, you know, language. It was really interesting. And then you just see this word that's like feminist, ING. So I don't remember the conversation that happened, but apparently we were brainstorming.
And I assume, and you can tell me if this is wrong, because maybe you had a grand plan. But I assume when you start this blog, as it was for a lot of us, it's kind of a lark. You're not
totally
saying, here's a space in feminism, I'm going to occupy it.
Right.
But what was your view of feminism at that moment, particularly for young feminists? Because you mentioned that sort of the leadership of some of these groups maybe was not that did not treat young feminists the way they should be, that there are only a couple young feminist voices. Like, how did you see the landscape at that moment?
It felt to me that there was a lot of excitement around feminism with younger women, but that wasn't necessarily being recognized. Mm-hmm. Working in the mainstream movement, all you would hear over and over again is like, oh, like younger women don't call themselves feminists. Younger women are not feminists. We need to make younger women feminists. And I was like, we are. I don't know what you're talking about. I see younger feminists all the time. But I think because they weren't in those traditional spaces like going to a NOW meeting, they were sort of invisible. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of the hope for the site, was to create a space where younger feminists who like didn't necessarily have a platform, like weren't groomed by Gloria Steinem and had a space at Ms. Magazine, could write and say something. And also the hope back then, like feminism was still very much the F word. There was like a lot of anti-feminist stereotypes, you know, of feminists as humorless. So we wanted something that was like sarcastic and funny and fun.
I thought that was really, again, not knowing the sort of internals of movement, certainly the way you did, but you guys from the start, and I don't remember exactly when I started reading, but just like had a really striking voice. I mean, I remember this is around the time my younger sister, who ultimately was a women's studies major, went to college. And I was like, you have to read this blog feministing, because I don't know, when I, to maybe digress here for a second, one of the first blogs I read was just a Blogspot blog called Demosthenes. Mm-hmm. It was named after the Ender's Game character, I believe. And I remember reading that blog. It's just a blog about politics, right? Just some guy or some woman maybe writing about politics. And I remember that the writer used the word props in response to something.
Right.
And I remember it actually, it sounds so weird to say, but I remember it hitting me like a thunderbolt. Like I had never seen or read someone write about politics in language that felt recognizable to me.
Totally.
Because like the language of op-ed pages, and particularly then the language of newspapers and op-ed pages, was very formal. It was this kind of like George Will quoting from the 15th century Swedish, you know, parliament. And that was really, you know, it made it feel like something that I could do. Like if you could write about politics as language, like maybe actually like kids could write about politics, which is certainly how I saw myself at that time. And I remember thinking that about when I, you know, started recommending feministing to people, that like it seemed to me to have a language and like an internal culture you could see yourself fitting into in a way that like a lot of the stuff that I saw academically around me, because I was in college at that time, did not feel that way.
Right. Well, that was both a deliberate decision and a reaction, I think, to writing press releases all day long. Right. So like I both was like, oh, I like need to just write in the way that I speak. But it was also a strategic decision in that I had just come out of grad school. I had gone for my master's in women's and gender studies and was considering going for a PhD, but ultimately decided not to because the theory was just so dense and all of the language around feminism, you really had to go to college, you had to go to grad school to be able to access this sort of language. And for me, so much of my feminism came from my mom, who like barely graduated high school. It just ceased to be useful to me. So I also, we wanted to write something. Someone with any level of education, any level of activist engagement could come and read and get something out of.
When did you start recognizing that feministing would be a thing?
There was a particular moment when, you know, we had comments, obviously, and
we all had comments.
We all had comments then. And Katha Pollitt commented on one of the posts, and we like got together like an emergency meeting. We're like, is it the real Katha Pollitt? Like, do you think that Katha Pollitt actually reads feminist? Like, we were so excited.
Just Katha Pollitt, the Nation.
The Nation columnist. Yeah, who is a huge inspiration. So we were freaking out. We're like, oh, people are actually reading this.
And did that change how you wrote? Did that change how you thought about it?
It didn't, because it seemed to be working. And at that time, you know, the comment section was really fun, and like sort of the men's rights folks hadn't quite caught on to us yet. And it was like a really vibrant, fun space.
Support for The Gray Area comes from Mint Mobile. When you hear secret sauce, maybe you think of the mysterious ingredient in your favorite burger. Or perhaps it's your grandmother's terrifying meatloaf, which somehow seemed to secrete sauce. But from now on, when you hear secret sauce, I want you to think about Mint Mobile. Their secret is that they only sell wireless service online. That means they can cut the cost of retail stores and pass those savings directly to you. By switching to Mint Mobile, you can get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/gray area. That's mintmobile.com/gray area. You can cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/gray area. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Wise is the app that makes using different currencies easy. Need to send dollars to your cousin in Bali fast? Getting paid in another currency and don't want to lose out because of inflated exchange rates? Want travel money without having to slog through the currency exchange kiosk? Then Wise might just be your answer. From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise takes the guesswork out of converting currencies. You can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees. In 2023, people sent over $100 billion worldwide with Wise. What's more, over half of those transfers got to their destination in less time than it takes to listen to this ad. Whether you're traveling, sending money abroad, or doing business, let Wise help you manage your money in different currencies with ease. Join 16 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account could work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com, Wise.com.
So to jump forward a little bit in time, I think of a lot of what has sort of come after in feminist websiting, mm-hmm. feminist content creation,
yeah.
as in some ways, you know, inspired by mm-hmm. those early sites. What do you think is different in terms of what someone who's reading Feministing or Feminist or, you know, mm-hmm. the sort of other blogs in that ecosystem, what do you think is different from of what they got from what you get if you're a young woman who starts today reading Jezebel and Broadly and Bustle and these more professionalized feminist, but not quite as explicitly so content places?
Right.
I don't mean content places in a bad way. It's just we're all multimedia now.
Yeah. Well, I think what's interesting is like then feminist blogs were sort of like the insurgent, like young writers. And now feminist blogs are the mainstream and the insurgent, like young activists and writers are on Tumblr and Twitter and spaces like that. I think it's really interesting that a lot of these folks have grown up with feminism. I mean, the strangest sort of turning point for me was realizing that younger feminists saw me as part of like the mainstream establishment.
Right.
Right. And they're like, oh, but like you're like executive editor of Feminist. I was like, what does that mean? Like I never got paid. Like this was always a side gig still.
Right.
But at a certain point, like it did shift where feministing was part of the mainstream conversation in the same way that like Jezebel did that. So that was a really strange shift, but it's also really wonderful because it means that this like generation of young feminists grew up with that as the norm.
It's interesting because it feels to me in the mainstream, non-mainstream distinction mm-hmm. you draw is an interesting one. There are a lot of discussions sort of happening right now today mm-hmm. that I try to think about them in terms of what the political fights and context were like when, you know, in 2003, 2004.
Yeah.
And one of them is the political correctness discussion, which I think is interesting in that it very much sees, I think, feminism and feminist ideas and feminist language as attaining a hegemonic status mm-hmm. in American life
mm-hmm.
that is nearly impossible to challenge. And almost putting aside whether that's true or untrue, it would have been so weird to have that argument in 2003 and 2004,
mm-hmm.
right? As you said, you were trying to say, like, people can call themselves feminists.
Right.
And now there seems to be a presidential candidacy as far as, you know, based mm-hmm. on the idea that you're not allowed to not call yourself a feminist and you
right.
should be able to. On the one hand, a lot of what's going on is depressing, but I'm curious if you see that as some kind of victory or something darker.
Well, no, I mean, we're fighting about it, and that's okay, right? Like it's part of the conversation, which is a lot more than we could say 10 years ago. So I don't mind that. Like the political correctness stuff, like, yeah, let's talk about it, let's hash it out. Like at least we're actually having the conversation rather than the conversation being like, oh, feminists are like miserable unmarried shrews, right? Like that was the conversation 10 years ago. So the fact that it shifted so much, I mean, I'm also just like an eternal optimist. Despite the tone of the book, I'm actually an eternal optimist.
Are there places where within the political correctness discussion, because I think that discussion is so ill-defined, like the set of practices people end up talking about when they talk about political correctness, are there places where you feel uncomfortable, where you've come to feel like the old centrist?
Of course, of course. But I think that that's part of the point, right? Like that's like the natural progression and evolution of things. And I should feel uncomfortable and I should feel like those young whippersnappers don't know what the hell they're talking about. Like I'm sort of okay with occupying that position because I think that that back and forth and that argument is part of progressing the movement. But I also think that like the stuff that gets the most attention is not necessarily, you know, like all this like stuff about trigger warnings. How many colleges like actually implement really serious trigger? Like they just don't. This is not like a real issue, but it's like very exciting for people to talk about. So I just don't know how real a lot of the controversy is. Like, yeah, you can like make fun of teenagers on Tumblr, but is that like really what you want to spend your time doing? They're trying to work it out, you know?
What do you think the trigger warning fight is about on both sides? If that question makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, I think for feminists, it's about just an acknowledgement that some conversations can be harder than others. And it's like a heads up, right? Like, I don't see a trigger warning as like, oh, like, don't read this, don't do this. And that's why a lot of places use content warnings. It's like, hey, like, this might be a little upsetting.
I remember buying CDs as a kid.
Right, like parental advisory.
Yeah, they had these little trigger warnings on them for my parents.
Right, and now, like, and on the other side, it's, oh, this is censorship. They're going to, you know, if you have trigger warnings on a syllabus, the kids are, you know, going to say, like, I'm not going to read that because for this reason and that reason. I'm sort of like, I come down somewhere in the middle, which is like, I always think it's nice to give people a heads up if something is like outrageously upsetting, of course. But if you're actually talking about trauma, PTSD, people's actual triggers differ so tremendously from person to person that that's actually not a like a useful exercise. Like as someone who had some PTSD after my kid was born, I remember having like a really bad anxiety episode and I couldn't figure out what had happened and like what, you know, like what had sparked it because it was years after my daughter was born. And a couple of hours later, I heard a truck outside beeping and the truck had been beeping for a few hours and I realized, oh, that's what it was because it reminded me of the beeping of the machines in the in the NICU. That's very individualized to me. Like there are certain things that are going to bring people back to a traumatic experience. And so I don't know how, you know, useful they are in practice.
I feel like there have become two versions of the political correctness debate that are happening simultaneously. One version strikes me as a new front in a war that was like very big in the 80s and early 90s, which is sort of academic theory, academic practices. And this is something that is tremendously interesting to people who went to like really good colleges.
Right.
And, you know, back then you had around postmodernism and feminist theory and these different things. And I went to Santa Cruz, which had had a lot of that and still did when I was there. So a lot of this stuff feels not at all new to me, which always makes me a little confused by its resurgence. But I think there's one side of it, which is another way to put it is practices on the frontier of the possible, right? People who are trying to institute new ways of talking about potentially upsetting content, people trying to implement new ways of talking about and thinking about transgender rights, things that the country doesn't really have an accepted, defined discourse around. And so there's a lot of friction there. And then I feel like there's this other thing that we are now talking about as political correctness within the presidential campaign. And like Donald Trump doesn't talk about trigger warnings.
Right.
He says immigrants are rapists. Or like the Hispanic judge has to recuse himself because he has Mexican heritage despite being born in Indiana. And I think there's something interesting there in the way that a debate that I think at the elite level takes place around, as you say, these fairly minor practices like trigger warnings then gets transmuted into what I sort of sometimes wonder is what it really is, which is a debate about much more fundamental conflicts about rights that we sometimes think are settled in American life, but actually are not.
Right. I mean, I think he's tapping in to a feeling that a lot of white men are having, you know, that's backlash related to all of the conversations around race and gender. It's been totally fascinating to watch, but really, really depressing. But I feel like when I listen to Donald Trump, like he reminds me of like every dude in a comment section, except he doesn't have anonymity. And I think that that's what's so exciting to other people, right? Like he's saying like what all these dudes say in comment threads, you know, except like he's completely proud to say it and is getting a platform to say it.
How do you think that the internet is different for this kind of debate when it moved from comment sections to social media? Because I think something changed there. Not that comment sections didn't have their horrors. Mm-hmm. Certainly they did. Mm-hmm. And certainly yours did.
Yeah.
But Donald Trump, I always think of as a creation of Twitter in a way.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the backlash question, I think what I saw was that trolling became an identity and not just a thing you do. When it transferred from comment sections to social media, comments was just something that you participated in. Social media is something that you are. And so all of a sudden now, like on Twitter, like people have whole accounts that are dedicated to just being a misogynist asshole. And so it became, I think, a lot more emotional for some of these folks and a huge part of who they are for better or worse, mostly worse.
Well, and I think that's a really profound point about this. And I've never thought about it that way. But related to that, when you did this in a comment section, mm-hmm. your audience was primarily hostile.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do it on social media, your audience is actually primarily applauding you, right?
Yeah, you're creating
your own follower sets, right? Because yep. I mean, there are a lot of these trolls that have followers of other like-minded folks. You know, they sometimes direct. I mean, you have sort of troll celebrities.
Right. And this is, again, I think a reaction to feminist spaces being seen as the mainstream, because then it allows these people to position themselves as like the oppressed minority in like against the terrible feminist overlords. I see it again and again, especially on social media. Now, like the latest place, you know, obviously Twitter harassment is very bad and that's what everyone talks about. But the place that I get the worst harassment now is on Instagram.
So I follow you on Instagram.
Yeah.
And it is so fucking jarring.
Yeah.
It's so much more jarring than it is in other spaces.
Because it's like I'm posting a picture of my dinner.
Yeah.
And someone's like, hey, cunt.
Yeah. You know? It is. I've seen this happen a bunch of times. So it'll be just like the most adorable domestic like picture. And so Instagram is really the only social network I personally enjoy.
Yeah.
Because it often seems like such like an easy, like
totally.
Chill space. You know, the only thing you can do is heart. And I mean,
right.
It really has built itself to be,
yeah.
They don't allow you to broadcast, right? You know, you can't have things go viral in the way
yep.
you can on other platforms. And I think they've done that and really have kept a personal feeling to it. And I've started having a bit of this too, but I see it much more on your feed. Like when you put up some – Instagram is a place you get the most personal in still a semi-public
yeah.
way. Or I shouldn't say you. I do.
Yeah.
And when that is interrupted, it feels very different.
Yeah.
I mean, I've not looked – I don't look at my Twitter mentions and haven't in 5 years.
That's
like,
very
I
smart.
Just fucking do not.
Yeah.
I don't look at Facebook comments. I just don't need
yeah.
that chaos
totally.
In my life, like good or bad.
Totally.
But Instagram, it's like I expect like, you know, my friends and family to comment. And when you
right.
see it happen there, it is – a different kind of thing.
It's very strange. And I think there's a couple of reasons for it. One is that a lot of the trollish Instagram users are very young. They're like 13 to 17 whenever I like sort of follow their – go back and look at their profiles. So I think part of it's that like they're young and they're making mistakes. But I think there's also something to the idea of on Twitter or in other places, it's easier to like – for my work, for example, to see me as like a set of controversial headlines
yeah.
rather than a person. So it's like it messes with their sort of point of view about who I am. They're like, oh, like here's this person who's like a mom and cooking dinner or like having a barbecue with her family and like, but she's not allowed to be a happy, you know, married mother. That completely is at odds with what I think about, you know, feminism.
So to do an empathy exercise here, because you and I have probably listened to some of these same pieces where people go and like they talk to their worst trolls and it's
yeah.
just some like person.
Yeah.
If you were to try to give this a sympathetic spin, right? If you were to try to ask yourself,
totally.
Like, what is happening here where folks are the hero of their own story?
Yeah.
Right? We're getting on your Instagram and underneath a picture of like you
helping your daughter blow out her birthday cake.
Yeah.
Like, just like a string of horrifying profanity.
Yeah.
What do you think is there that should be, if anything, that should be understood as opposed to simply condemned?
I mean, I think people are in pain. Like, all of us are in pain in one way or another. And I think that some people don't handle that pain as well as others. You know, that doesn't mean that I think that, like, there's an excuse for it or that, like, some people aren't just terrible, mean people. And I tend to think that that's true, especially of a lot of, like, the older trolls. But with younger guys, especially, and teenagers, I think that they are trying to sort it out. Like, they are trying to work out their feelings around masculinity and women. And when they come into spaces, online spaces, that are like, all of these complicated feelings you're having are because women won't fuck you or because feminists are telling these lies. That's a really simple answer for really complicated feelings that they're having. And so I think that that's part of it. Lindy West did a great, she did a This American Life on approaching one of her trolls. I've had similar stuff happen. Like, I had a kid who was threatening me and I contacted his family and they sort of made him apologize to me. And as it turned out, his sister had just died a few weeks earlier. Again, that doesn't excuse it, but it's like people are in pain and they're acting out.
The invocation of pain there is interesting. I mean, something that I have seen more and more of traveling around the internet, and this is not from just trolls, right? This is from people who are talking, I think, in a less trollish way about political correctness and broader questions about the discourse. And something I see a lot is a real frustration over what they consider to be oversimplified ideas of what the power dynamics really are, right? And I think you see this in particular. You see a lot of, like, young folks who self-identify as nerds and who say, I get bullied constantly. I am alone in ways that society tells me, like, completely take away my self-worth. And then I come online and I keep just being told, I am the power, I am the power, I am the power. My experience is not valid. And how do you think about those kinds of overlapping power and lack of power? I mean, there are so many ways that we take and give up status in our lives.
Totally.
And sometimes we talk about it in one, but I often feel like a lot of that pain is motivated by people saying, like, no, you don't understand. Like, I am actually powerless and don't know what to do about it, or feel powerless and don't know what to do about it.
I think part of the problem is that we haven't found a way to translate the difference between, like, individual versus systemic power and the way that that functions. Not that I think we need to give people a break, because, like, I don't. People can be jerks. But I do think that we need to understand, like, it can be hard for people who are feminists, who are political, you know, like, to understand that. It was a really hard thing for me to understand as a person who felt relatively powerless, to understand at a certain point, like, hey, I'm writing books. I have a big platform. I have a lot of power. Like, this is, you know, not the same as it was. That can be a difficult thing to recognize when in your everyday life you don't feel it. So I do think that we need to do a better job sort of distinguishing for people. But that can be hard to do when it's not a conversation, but it's, you know, someone screaming at you online.
Yeah, it is, I think, one of the things that feels most different to me the first 5 years as I had as a writer, and, like, the last however many, six or seven, where then it felt like the people who were arguing with me or didn't like me, they wanted a response. And if you responded, you could have a dialogue. Whereas at a certain point, it flipped. And as you say, like, I kind of became like a jumble of headlines. And that there's no way really to have a dialogue. And so certainly I'll say only for myself that in a lot of these cases, I just shut myself off from it. Like, I just don't read the mentions or whatever it might be. But on the other hand, you know, to your point, I also feel that that approach worsens the problem in some fundamental way, that it makes me seem more aloof. It makes me seem, I'm only speaking for myself here, but it makes me seem more unwilling to hear dissent, whatever. And I have my, you know, I certainly, like, read a lot of this stuff, so I do hear it. But there's something in there in terms of, like, what you end up feeling your responsibilities are to that conversation that's very hard to navigate, I find.
Totally. And I'm sort of, like, what's difficult is I'm on the cusp of doing what you do and completely, like, shutting myself off to it. Like, for a long time, I've really held back from that because I do feel like a lot of my readers are younger feminists. Like, I like having a back and forth with them, but I do have to sort of navigate all this horror to get there. And I do worry about, like, oh, it's like now, like, she's too good, like, to even respond or to, like, check her mentions, right? Like, I get that. But the truth is that, like, anyone with a certain follower count or, like, public-facing profile gets dehumanized to a certain extent online. Like, you're not a – you know what I mean? There's literally nothing I could say to some people that would make them satisfied with my response because I am literally not a person to them. I am a caricature of what a feminist is.
Right. No, I mean, it's such an interesting thing. I remember it happened when I was at – late in my job at the American Prospect, and – I think we used to call it fisking, right, in the blogosphere when you like went paragraph by paragraph and attacked something like in like a super vicious way. And somebody who I did this to like emailed me and they kind of said, the people you attack read you now.
Totally.
And care what you think. And in a way that maybe is corrupting, that had a huge effect on me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I realized like I had not thought of them as reading me. I kind of thought of this as for my little audience,
absolutely,
not for the people. And I realized, like, okay, like, if I'm going to be worried about them, like, I better be sure I'm being kind of fair to them because, like, this can ruin my day. I'm sure it can ruin theirs.
Right.
You know, it was very strange for me to make that transition, like, from a blogger who did not feel like the people I was attacking would read me and so did not really feel like they would care and so did not feel bound by normal laws of civility and in the way you would talk to someone who you're actually talking to. And then to ultimately end up on the other side of that myself, which again is not something I'm lamenting. Like I'm, you know, I've chosen the career I have, and I'm happy for it. But it's just such a different thing to engage with or try to figure out, disengage with. And to your point about pulling back, you know, for me, a lot of the reason I ended up thinking that was a good idea was just that in terms of serving the bulk of my audience, which is mostly people who are not tweeting at me, mostly people who are not, even the people who are nicely tweeting at me, just mostly just readers, right, or watchers or listeners or whatever, I would not have like the capacity if I let all the feedback come too close. Like I would lose my ability to actually say the things I wanted to say and think clearly because I think that amount of feedback, and I've said this on the podcast before, I don't think human beings are built for that amount of feedback. Like, whatever, we're built for communities of 300 people, right? Isn't that the line? I do not think we're built for the amount of feedback you can get now on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and comment sections and emails. It's just too much. And I think you, like, I found myself anyway, like, losing my own sense of what I thought or who I was or what I was trying to achieve other than turning the dial of that feedback away from negative and towards positive.
Mm-hmm. It's really difficult because like on a purely career level, it would be really difficult for me to just stop doing that. Like, right, like Twitter is the biggest platform that I have. My publisher would be furious if I stopped checking mentions, right? Like I wonder what impact it would have on my writing career. But you're right, like I don't think that we're built for that. But in a strange way, all of that feedback and harassment, I think, was in big part why I decided to write this book now and like why it came out, because I just got to that sort of crisis point where I was like, like I need to do something with myself. So maybe in some way it was positive.
What was the first chapter of this book that you wrote? You told me that some of this came about organically. You were writing for yourself on the side as catharsis. What was the first chapter that emerged?
It was Line Violence, which is the first essay in the book, which is about generational sexual violence in my family and my feelings about being a mom and sort of feeling powerless to stop the bad stuff that happens to girls from potentially happening to my daughters. So that I had written that, and it was actually a lot more depressing than it is now, which doesn't say a lot. And I toned it back a bit. And I remember Andrew, my husband, reading it. He's like, "Oh, he's like, this is really hard to read." And I was like, "I'm going to keep doing it."
Was it hard for Andrew to read the book?
I think it was very hard for him to read the book. I think he was proud of me and was happy that I was doing it. But he loves me, and it's you know, I think that there's a lot of pain shines through in the book. And so I think that that's hard to see, like knowing that your partner is in pain. And then, of course, there's just like, you know, some random stuff about him that was hard for him to read personally.
Vacations can be tricky. You already know how to book flights and hotels, but now the only thing you're missing is, you know, the actual travel experience. Because is it really a vacation if you're just sitting around like you would at home? You need a tool to get the most out of your time away. That's where Viator steps in. You can book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
This podcast is supported by Choiceology, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Choiceology is a show all about the psychology and economics behind our decisions. Each episode shares the latest research on behavioral science and dives into questions like, can we learn to make smarter decisions? And what is the power of negative thinking? The show is hosted by Katie Milkman. She's an award-winning behavioral scientist, professor at the Wharton School, and author of the best-selling book, How to Change. In each episode, Katie talks to authors, athletes, Nobel laureates, and more about why we make irrational choices and how we can make better ones. Choiceology is out now. Listen and subscribe at schwab.com/podcast or find it wherever you listen.
I don't want to ask exactly what is the message of the book, but the book is told through a series of stories. And the stories have a very common set of themes, but you write in the beginning, I think like really powerfully, about specific ways in which this book is for your daughter and the world you want her to inhabit and the person you want her to be. And so what is the effect you're hoping this book has on a 15-year-old who reads it?
It's such a hard question. I mean, I think that the best I can hope for is like the message I wish I would have gotten when I was 15, which is that the world is messy. And so like expect to be a mess yourself. I don't think I was fully prepared for how much I would blame myself for not handling a really chaotic world. Things can be very tough for women, but we're meant to just like live in it and go through it day to day without sort of showing any impact or being worse for the wear, which I don't think is realistic. And I think women carry around a lot of self-doubt and self-hatred for not handling it better when in fact we should not be handling it. Like it is terrible and it's okay to feel really fucked up about it.
The thing that the book I think did super well, and the thing that's I think really hard and important to read as a male reader of the book is the unrelentingness of it.
Yeah.
I mean, what you've done in the book is pull stories out of a lot of different phases of your life, a lot of different spaces you're in, from school to the subway to the professional world. You know, things of varying levels of goodness or awfulness happen. But what it made me think about a lot reading it was the unrelentingness of being viewed specifically as a woman, or as the book's title is, as a sex object, which I really don't think is an experience men, even if they haven't noticed. Right.
Right.
Like I had like plenty of my problems growing up and was bullied and, you know, had all kinds of shit. But I did not have a single unrelenting way I was continuously viewed and treated.
Right.
It was less than the sum of my parts in the same fashion every single time for decades and decades.
And that's the thing is like, how can you? And that's the question I was really trying to get at with Layla, my daughter, is like, how can I prepare her for that? I don't have the language for that, right? Like, we don't have language to explain what that feels like, what that is, what that means, especially because it is so unrelenting and differs from space to space. It's really easy to say, like, if you're on the subway, like, a guy may flash you and that's going to feel terrible. But, like, how do you connect that and relate that to looks you'll get or a small comment that a teacher might make? It's really difficult to articulate, especially when you're thinking about kids and growing up.
Well, there's a weird and, to me, really chilling privacy to that experience. Mm-hmm. So I think of this all the time in the catcalls discussion.
Mm-hmm.
My wife and every woman I know in D.C. talks a lot about being catcalled, particularly walking around at night alone.
Yeah.
And it is a case that in all the years I have walked around with my wife or with other female friends or women mm-hmm. I dated, I don't think I have ever heard a catcall happen near me.
Right.
Or at least not to the person I was with.
Right, right, right.
And the omnipresence of that experience mixed with the total absence of it from yeah. my life,
yeah.
it has always been such a shocking thing to me.
Yeah.
One thing about it, and I think one thing about a lot of the moments in this book are they happen very privately.
Yeah.
Right? It's like something that happens in an instant on a subway. And it's one way in which I think, you know, it's something I've certainly been sensitized to in recent years, but how much of this I just don't see. Men just don't see. It's not mm-hmm. like you see the world and you're just...
Yeah.
You've got the picture, but you're not interpreting it right. You're just not seeing a lot of the picture.
I'm so glad that you brought this up because it's something that happens privately, but in public spaces, right? So it's happening yeah. privately, but it's happening publicly as well, which is part of what I think makes it so difficult because those are public spaces. You're supposed to be able to walk through public spaces with a certain level of safety. And I do think that it's somewhat invisible to men. I've had this experience more than once with Andrew and with other guys I've dated where I've been catcalled and the guy I was standing with haven't noticed because not that it was like some screaming guy from across the street, but like a guy, like you're walking in one direction with your partner and a guy is walking in another direction. And as you walk by him, he says something really softly in your ear or really? He like gives you a look and you know exactly what that look means or he licks his lips in a certain way. Gross. Yeah, totally gross. And
there's a non-podcastable wince around that one.
And I remember saying, did you just fucking see that? And he's like, no, what do you mean? Like, what are you talking about? And I think part of that is like, why would Andrew or any other guy like be paying close attention to the man who's walking towards us? Like women have been trained to be on guard. Like I can tell, and I wrote this in the book, I can tell from a half a block away when a guy is going to say something yeah. disgusting to me. Like you can just tell. And I know that I'm not alone in feeling this. And so we are sort of been trained to notice it more.
But that training to be on guard, that seemed like the one of the truly terrible costs. So one of the writers at Vox mm-hmm. was because she's at the New York Times now, mm-hmm. but a tremendous writer named Amanda Taub. And she talked about what she called the consent tax. Mm-hmm. But she talked about a lot of this stuff as a tax, that yeah. there is this small tax that is put on a lot of women all the time, the tax of being on guard in public, which takes yep. energy, the tax of making sure that, you know, when you're at a conference, you're not left alone in a room with the guy, you know, just
right.
like the tax of having to watch all this stuff. And like a lot of taxes, even if it's not a high payment at any given moment, it really, really, really adds up.
Yeah. There are researchers who study something called objectification theory, which is like the way in which women react to being sexually objectified and start to see themselves from sort of like a third person point of view. And they've been able to like directly link it to anxiety, depression, psychological distress. Like these things have tangible impacts.
There's a set of research I've been following recently, and it's actually about some of it's done by over at the World Bank, among others by a friend of mine, Bilal Siddiqui, that is about actually truth and reconciliation commissions mm-hmm. in other countries. And what it found was that on the one hand, reliving these experiences through these commissions does lead to more forgiveness, does lead to more
right.
Reconciliation, but it also leads to more trauma, more anxiety, mm-hmm. more upset, that the experience of not suppressing what is going on
right.
has real negative, really genuinely
right.
negative impacts. And I wonder a bit about that in terms of this discussion. Something that I think has really happened in the last, let's say, 10, 20 years has been a sensitization of, among other things, very specifically, women to what's going on, right? Seeing this stuff is not normal, it's not okay.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you think that, not at all trying to say here that it's not good that this stuff is being called
sure.
out and made clear, but that the experience of having to see it as like a real thing that is being done all the time, do you think that has made it harder?
I think in some ways, yes. But in most ways, no. I mean, I think that, yes, it's always going to feel painful to talk about these issues, to relive them. But it's much better to do that in a group, right? And not mm-hmm. feel alone about it. And I think that that's why, like, you saw that hashtag Yes All Women take off
yeah.
in the way that it did. Because I think for a lot of women, and I've heard this a lot from older women who I've spoken to, it was just because it was not something that you talked about, they thought it was something that was wrong with them, that they were like attracting this sort of behavior in a way that other women weren't. So I think that the act of talking about it can be incredibly helpful on a more sort of like existential level, maybe not like in that moment.
And do you think that the act of talking about it and calling it out more and having it more as part of the discourse is changing anything about it, is lessening it? I mean, do you, I guess a different way of putting the question and a more simple one is, do you think this stuff is getting better? Not laws, but actually the way it is to be a woman in high school.
Not yet. I mean, I think what we're seeing right now is like a lot of women are telling their stories. I feel like we're in the midst of the backlash to their to those stories, where a lot of people are like talking about women only writing first-person essays, and this is so frivolous, and this is so superficial, and women should be writing about more serious stuff, as if women's experiences are not serious and important. I do think, though, we're going to hit a tipping point with it, and I am starting to sort of see that in high schools, and like it's a small thing, but I think it's sort of crazy. Like just watching on Tumblr, the amount of high school girls who are like protesting their dress codes. Which is like such like it's like one very specific issue, but they get it. They're like protesting in a way like where they really get it, where they're saying like, my body is not a distraction to a boy's learning. What's a distraction to learning is a girl being pulled out of her class and made to change into a like a sweatsuit because you can't handle seeing like some bare shoulders. So I do feel like things are getting better, but just in a slow way.
You brought up Tumblr a couple of times, and it's something that I've not talked about on the show at all, in part because I don't feel like I fully understand it myself.
Nor do I.
Something that happened, and maybe nobody does, something that happened the last 3 or 4 years, as far as I can tell, is that Tumblr has become the locus of a lot of what gets grouped as these social justice conversations.
Totally.
It's a space that happens, I think, outside. The media is pretty good now at watching Twitter, pretty good at watching Facebook, and has no idea how to watch Tumblr. I mean, some places like BuzzFeed are pretty good at it, but a lot of us aren't. Why do you think Tumblr has emerged in this way? And like, what should people kind of culturally think about it?
I mean, I think it's because people are not watching it as closely as why teenagers love it so much, and it has the power that it does. People should watch it because that is where young people are learning about these issues. Ask a group of like teenagers or even like college freshmen where they first learned the term rape culture. None of them will say school. They will all say Tumblr. I've asked this question again and again. Like, this is the entry point to the conversation for them. So if we care about what that conversation looks like and how that conversation is being shaped, then we need to be there.
To go back to the question a second, on the other side of the are things getting better, what have you thought watching the Hillary Clinton campaign?
Oh, so many things. So many things. I mean, again, being an eternal optimist, I'd like to think that, you know, her running against like basically like a misogynist supervillain will do something to open up the national conversation on gender, hopefully in a way that is a little bit more nuanced than in 2008 when the conversation was really about like much more explicit sexism, right? It was like the iron my shirt and her cackling laugh. The conversation was like trying to make people understand that that was sexist. And now it's about sort of the more insidious sexism. I feel hopeful that the conversation will happen, but I am also just scared. I'm just really scared to see. I think that I've always had like a creeping suspicion that like people are a lot more misogynist than I'd like to think, right? Like at the heart of it, most of the time I'm pretty optimistic and I'm like, no, if you just explain to people, they would understand. And now with Trump, it's like, oh, maybe that's not true. Maybe people really do think this. And that's a distressing thought to have.
Before putting Trump aside for a minute, I feel like there's a question that gets asked a lot, which is, are reactions to Clinton herself, let's say maybe gendered to be more gentle about it? And to ask the question maybe in a sharper way, there's the sort of counterfactual of Elizabeth Warren or of Amy Klobuchar or of someone else, right? Which is in this question of, you know, Hillary Clinton is this incredibly intensely polarizing politician, like the least popular nominee ever in polling, aside from Donald Trump, who is the most unpopular nominee ever in polling. And one thing you'll hear is that the reason, you know, Hillary Clinton is so polarizing is because she's been a woman in the public eye, and pretty a woman in the public eye for a long period of time. But people say, no, it's not a gendered thing. Elizabeth Warren's favorables look very different. And if she had run or one of these other women had run, we'd be having a fully different conversation. Which side of that do you fall on?
Somewhere in the middle. Like, I don't buy this idea that, like, if it was Elizabeth Warren, like, sexism wouldn't be an issue. Like, I just don't buy it. Like, there would be something. It might look different than the way that we talk about Hillary Clinton, because, as you said, she's been in the public eye for so long. But, like, I 100% don't buy it. And I also don't think that people can separate out the sexism that neatly. I think that people would like to think that they can. So much misogyny is really unconscious, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's not, you can still be sexist and not call Hillary a bitch.
Right.
Right. Like, there are lots of ways to be sexist. So no, like, I just don't buy it.
What is a way that you think that sort of unconscious sexism or unconscious bias manifests if people are not paying attention to you? Like, as you said, I think there's now a discourse that when somebody says, oh, Hillary Clinton should stop shouting or she should smile more, people are saying, no, that's, shut up, that's incredibly sexist. She's standing next to Bernie Sanders. He does not, and God bless him for it, he does not shout. But what are the things that you think don't get, not just called out, but don't get noticed, that are structuring people's perceptions here but are not being understood for what they are?
Right. I mean, there's a lot of little things. I think one thing that I've been thinking a lot about is this question of, like, her ambition or wanting it too badly, and this criticism of, like, oh, like, she just wants it so badly. And it's like, yeah, like, she's running for president. Like, people tend to want that. Like, you have to be super ambitious. But just, like, the inability to interrogate what it is that we find so, like, viscerally distasteful about a woman really wanting power, right? Or, like, saying that someone is power hungry.
Do you think that only happens to women? I mean, I've heard
this.
No,
I think that happens.
Like, I remember a lot of talk of, like, Obama. Like, people like, Obama in kindergarten wrote an essay about how he wanted to be president. Mitt Romney got a lot of shit for, like, people believing he was, like, a robot programmed for the presidency, like, early in the, I guess, construction phase. On the one hand, I agree with that. And on the other hand, I don't know what to think about that.
Right.
Like, I don't know why we think people shouldn't want to be president in the first place.
It's like, they better want to be president. They, like, really better want it very badly.
We seem to want somebody who just, like, woke up one day and is like, all right.
this is good.
Let's do it.
Yes. Like, we critique men for wanting something, but I don't think that we, like, emotionally feel the same disdain for them that we do for, like, and I think that emotional reaction is the issue. And, like, I have seen this a bit on the left recently, like, let's say not with Hillary Clinton, but with, like, attacking professional feminists, like, professional feminist writers, and I won't name any names to bring any more attention to them, but I've seen them, like, attacked from the left because they went on a particular vacation or they're making a certain amount of money, and the distaste was just palpable. It was like, how dare you have access to this kind of power or make money or live in a nice house. And I just don't see that same thing happening to male writers.
Well, there was that sort of horrible thing recently with Ta-Nehisi Coates.
That was absolutely horrible. But that wasn't like he doesn't deserve to live there. That was just people being really, really stupid and not understanding the way that harassment and threats work online.
Yeah, I think there's a fucking lot of that. But I do think the point you just brought up is interesting. One of the things I've been thinking about a bit just watching the primary was thinking about the emotional registers that people are allowed to go into. And thinking about the way in which it was much remarked on that a quality Obama has is a preternatural cool. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean cool in the sense of what a cool guy. I mean cool in the sense of, like, you cannot ruffle him, right? He has a calm that is almost otherworldly. And people saying, like, this is because, in part, if you are going to be an African-American man, like, achieving at the level he is and trailblazing in the way he did, you are not going to be able to present as angry. Like, you just can't. You have to learn how to not do that. And this seems to me to be true a bit for Clinton, too. And I think it connects to something I've been trying to think through, because I feel this, too, right? Mm-hmm. I can look at Clinton and think, like, there does feel to me like an inauthenticity there. And then you talk to people who work for her and they feel that she's the most warm, normal person.
Yeah.
And sometimes I wonder how much of this is that a candidate like Donald Trump or a candidate like Bernie Sanders can exist in very unusual emotional registers you would not run into in normal life.
100%, yeah.
But that a candidate like Obama or Clinton, a candidate dealing with other racial or gendered stereotypes, has to force themselves into a more narrow band of emotional reaction. And in doing, then when you they look artificial to people, well, yeah, they're having to put a lot of caps on how they feel about things.
Absolutely. I mean, it's almost like I sort of, especially like with Sanders and Clinton, like debating, you can almost see like the invisible box around her. Right? Like in terms of physical space, like Sanders has the ability to like wave his arms and like just like wildly like go nuts with his body language and everything like that. Like he has this freedom of physical movement, right? That Clinton could never do. Like if her arms went outside of this invisible box space, it would be like, ah, she's making a move for you. Like, watch out. Just in physical ways and emotional ways. Like, yes, absolutely. I do think that Clinton is not as natural a politician as other people, but I think that what you're saying is a big part of that.
So let me ask you the flip of that then. Barack Obama has said before that when people talk about the way race played into his election, he said, look, there were ways in which it hurt me. There's no doubt. And he said there are ways in which it helped me. There were a lot of people excited about the first African-American president. And I think it is fair to say that there has not been a commensurate amount of excitement, a feeling of firstness, a feeling of this being a historic legacy campaign around Clinton and the first female president. Do you think that is something about the first female president? Do you think it's something about Hillary Clinton and the fact that we know so much about her, she can't sort of act as a vessel for, you know, ideas about America the way Obama could, who just had less baggage? Or do you think like that I'm totally off base and there is the same amount of excitement?
I think that there's a lot of excitement, but there's like a generational excitement gap, and unfortunately. And I think that that has to do with some younger women feeling like they're going to see a female president in their lifetime. And so they're not as revved up about it. But I do think it also has to do with like the particular space that that gender occupies right now, unfortunately. But maybe there's like a generational gap with like younger women who can vote. But in my daughter's kindergarten class, the young women there are very excited. I can say there's a lot of excitement on like the very young people level.
Damn those closed primaries where kindergarteners can't.
It's like very, very funny to watch these conversations happen when like Layla came home. She's like, so-and-so is voting for Trump. And I was like, really? Like, who are her parents again? Like, give me their names. It is sort of strange to watch, but I come from like a strange point of view on it because I voted for Obama in 2008. And I didn't feel that sense of excitement around Hillary. And I wasn't thinking about the first female president in the same way that I am now. And I have no idea if that has to do with my political progression or my age. I think it's probably the latter. I'm getting a lot more impatient and ornery as I close in on 40. And so, yeah, I mean, I would like to see more excitement.
Do you think that there is – how much of this do you think is systemic and how much of it do you think is particular? Do you think if this had been the candidacy of – another woman, a woman who maybe burst onto the scene more recently, like an Elizabeth Warren, we would see more of that?
I just don't know. I don't think so. I mean, I think part of the conversation I'm seeing happen right now is this idea that part of being a good – this is just like one conversation that's happening. Part of being a good feminist is like not seeing gender, right, when you're voting, which feels really short-sighted and strange to me.
What would be the – walk me through that argument a little bit.
Well, just meaning that a real feminist vote is for the most feminist candidate, regardless of gender. But from my point of view, you know, taking gender into account when you're voting and the abysmal political representation that we have when it comes to women is a really, really important part of politics as well, and not like a soft issue, not like a superficial issue. It's not that I'm like vain and want to see myself reflected in a powerful position. It's a real political issue. Like on the world stage, we do terribly. Like we have terrible political representation when it comes to women. That is a real issue. But it's been really interesting to see making that argument and having people take that to mean gender is the only issue I care about. So if you care about gender at all, it must mean it's the only thing that's driving you.
So you've written how many books now?
This will be my fifth.
What is the best advice you've ever gotten about writing a book?
Oh, goodness. Well, this is the best career advice I've gotten, and I've taken this to heart when writing a book, that anything worth doing is something that's going to make you feel like you're going to throw up.
Cool.
Yeah, which has been true. Which has been true for me. I definitely feel like today is the day that we're talking is pub day for the book. I have felt nauseous all morning. Yeah.
That's such an interesting idea. So, because I struggle with this a bit. Stuff I'm doing now, I find much harder than things I did, you know, in previous guises of my work. And, you know, there is this kind of line of thought that if it's hurting, it's better.
Yeah.
I always wonder that. I always wonder if I'm not just doing something wrong and that's why it's hurting.
No, I think if you're challenging yourself, like, you should be uncomfortable, like, even physically uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. When things get too easy, I mean, maybe this is not, like, it depends on what you're trying to accomplish. Like, perhaps this is not, like, the best work-life balance advice, right? It's like, oh, make sure you're always feeling a little uncomfortable and a little on edge. But it's actually, like, whenever I feel comfortable in a position, it's when I'm not, like, doing my best.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever I feel uncomfortable, it's because I'm tapping into something that I think is important.
How did you develop your book voice? The way in which I ask that is thinking back to Feministing, mm-hmm. it had this sort of very personal, colloquial, informal, like it really had this quality of like your friend talking to you at the bar, as a lot of our other blogs did. And the book has a very different, more elevated, more literary tone. Is that a tone that you had to sort of, or are you sort of good at mimicking other voices as a writer? Or how did that emerge?
That's a really great question. Thank you. You're welcome. I think I have been writing informally for so long. And like now it's so funny. Like if I go back and like I was at a college recently and they asked me to like read from Full Frontal and it was just painful. Like it was just the most painful experience. I was like, ugh, did I really like talk and write like this 10 years ago? This is terrible. So I think it's, you know, just in part being older and my voice has changed. But I was actually really lucky. Like part of the way that the sort of tone for this book came about was I was writing a food column for The Toast, rest in peace, and
the fucking dream writing about food.
I know, right? I was like, well, you know, Mallory and Nicole contacted me. They're like, we'd really love for you to write something for us. I was like, will you let me write about food? And to their credit, they're like, sure, no problem. So I started writing this food column, and because my relationship with food is so much about my relationship with my family and my mother, it just tapped into something really different for me.
Uh-huh.
And so the writing was different. And through that column, which was pretty short-lived, but I was really glad to do it, I was able to sort of stretch those muscles a little bit. And when I did, it felt scary to me because it was definitely a different kind of writing, newer for me. But the reaction I got was so supportive and so great, and people really liked it that I decided to just like go with it.
When you think about how to allocate the time you can spend reading, because you have a family, you have a job, you have speaking, you have all these things.
Yeah.
And then you can read Twitter, you can read newspaper articles, you can read books, you can read magazine pieces. How do you think about allocating the time you have to learn new things through reading?
It's funny that you say learn new things, because I was going to say most of what I read are books that I've read a million times.
Oh, really?
Over. Yeah. I do a lot of fiction reading, and I've had like the same, you know, five or so books on my nightstand, and I just reread them over and over and over again. For me, I think that that's just like a grounding and a comforting. Uh-huh. You know, I feel like when you do so much work online, you can feel sort of disconnected. And so for me,
what are the books?
Oh, goodness. Right now, I'm rereading 100 Years of Solitude, which I do every year, which has like become sort of like a joke between Andrew and I. Play It As It Lays, Joan Didion, and Their Eyes Were Watching God. And I just finished the Elena Ferrante set, which was like, have you read it?
I haven't. I want to read it.
Andrew is like trying to work through the first one. He has a harder time with fiction than I do. They were really, really fun and great.
I think that's super interesting that you reread the same books. It's funny because I've never heard of anybody doing that over and over and over again. And I've never thought of doing it, but as soon as you say it, it makes complete sense why you would. So I watch the same shows over and over and over again, right? I mean, if I am like having a long day, like I will just watch the episode of Parks and Rec where Chris Traeger gets the flu. Like that is, as
That's
far as I'm
episode.
Concerned, the peak that culture has reached in this country. And you know, oftentimes when I'm trying to find fiction, which I think probably like Andrew, I have a little bit of a harder time with, and I'm just kind of nagging like, oh, you should be reading some hard, you know, book about policy because you don't do any reporting anymore. And I have a lot of guilt around my reading, which is why I ask people about it. But you know, I'm often looking for fiction. I'm like, I would love to find something like The Art of Fielding or like, right, you know, some book that has brought me a lot of joy or comfort. But I don't remember these books. Like, I should just reread them a bunch
you
of times.
You should just reread them. It's really nice. It just feels very, comforting and really comfortable and like relaxing to me.
But also you reread like classic greatest 100 books of all time, sort of like that. I feel like that's almost a cop out.
But those are the books I really like. I'm like trying to think of really, what else that are not like.
If you go to your house, it's like one day I'm going to like come over and it's going to be like Dean Koontz and it's going to
be. Well, listen, I was an English major, right? Like I was like an English major nerd and I was this is not embarrassing, but I was like a Shakespeare nerd. Like,
oh, really?
I like focused on Shakespeare. So like you'll also find me doing a lot of that reading. But I think that has to do with I also did a lot of acting in high school. And so like I like the almost feeling like you're reading out loud, and reading plays are really good for
my wife was also an English literature major, and it makes me feel so uncultured.
That's what Andrew says. And I'm like, you went to Harvard. I went to SUNY. Relax. Like, you know?
I also am married to someone who went to Harvard, and I also went to a public
college.
And I feel very uncultured all the time.
I'm glad I'm not the only one.
Well, this is a question I normally ask, but to maybe focus in a different direction, what are some books about feminism specifically, that if someone is listening to this and wants to get a bit of a grounding, that have influenced you and that you think are books people should actually read? Not books that people should have read, but are books that people should read.
Yeah. I think if you want sort of a really great, like, current understanding of what's going on, I think Roxane Gay's Bad Feminist is a must read. The book that really changed my thinking on a lot of things was Julia Serrano's Whipping Girl about transgender issues, which I think people should absolutely read, not just because of the take on transgender issues, but sort of conversations around femininity and what femininity means in America. And of course, like Bell Hooks, Feminism is for Everybody. I think that's like a really nice, if you're coming to it, that's a really nice book to start with.
What's something that you believe is true that most people believe is false?
That the Underworld movies were excellent and amazing.
All of them?
All of them. I really enjoy like werewolf and vampire movies. Not of like the Twilight variety, but of like the
like the Blade variety.
Yeah, I love Blade.
Blade is great.
Not
Blade 3.
No, yeah, well, I could watch it. I really like, and this is like a point of contention for me and Andrew too, because like Andrew would be very happy to watch like documentaries all day, and I really want to watch like some gory sci-fi bullshit.
I feel really bad about my apparent inability to watch documentaries.
Really?
Yeah, I do not. I'm always like, can I have the information faster? Like, if I'm going to do that, I'm going to read it.
If
I'm going to watch stuff, I just watch.
Andrew enjoys, like, he gets into it. He enjoys it. And I just find it so tedious. Which is terrible. And he, like, used to work for Frontline. So, like, that's good, you know. So he should. And that's good. But for me, no. But I also just like to turn my brain off. You know what I mean? Like, I'm writing and talking about, like, rape and assault and abortion all day. Like, sometimes you just want to watch some vampires kill some werewolves.
Is there anything I should have asked you that I didn't?
Oh, goodness.
This is a new question a listener suggested.
Oh, that is a good question. Not that I can think of. I'm gonna say no. I mean, because it's your show, man.
Is it?
I think
it's all of our shows.
It's all of our shows. It's very generous.
It was awesome. It's super great to see you, to get a chance to talk to you.
Thank you for having me. Your book is great.
People really should read it.
Thank you.
And yeah, Jessica Valenti, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
That was Jessica Valenti. Again, my praise for the book is real. You should check it out. I think it's really worth reading. I appreciate the time she was here. Thank you to my producer, AC Valdez. Thank you to Panoply and Vox.com for putting on this fine show. And thank you to all of you. You are fine people to spend an hour or so, or however long, with me each week. I hope you're back with me next week.
Support for this show comes from Fundrise. Buy low, sell high. It's easy to say, hard to do. For example, high interest rates are crushing the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices are falling, even for many of the best assets. It's no wonder the Fundrise Flagship Fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its billion-dollar real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise Flagship Fund to your portfolio in just minutes and with as little as $10 by visiting fundrise.com/fox. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise Flagship Fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement.